This is Scott Berglin of KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. We are going to turn to the issue, the information about Haiti, the current situation in Haiti. We have on the line from Port-au-Prince, I believe, Aaron Lakoff, who's an independent journalist and activist from Montreal, Quebec. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, Scott, and hello to your listeners.
Well, thank you for... thank you for taking the time for to discuss and update us on this important issue, which unfortunately is way below the radar for most people in the United States. And let's hope we can raise it a little bit. Could you start off by giving us some background on the background that brings us to the situation that's currently going on in Haiti?
Sure. Well, actually, it's quite interesting. We had a chance to speak to a Haitian activist today, a man by the name of Patrick A. Lee, who really put the current situation in Haiti in terms of a very broad historical framework. I mean, when we're talking about Haiti, it's important to mention the fact that Haiti is the world's oldest black republic. They won their independence from the French in 1804 during a slave revolt. The slaves here in Haiti had an uprising against their slave masters. And then to jump ahead 200 years in history, what happened was January the 1st, 2004, Haitians celebrated the bicentennial anniversary of their independence, and then not even 2 months later, on February the 29th, 2004, the United States, France, and Canada helped to sponsor and lead a coup d'etat against Haiti's democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He was forced onto a plane on that night of February 29th and flown to the Central African Republic, and he is now living in exile in South Africa. And President Aristide himself describes what happened to him on that night as a kidnapping. Most Haitians he will speak to agree overwhelmingly that it was a coup d'etat and it was a kidnapping. And unfortunately, what we hear in the institutional media and the institutional press throughout Canada and the U.S. is that President Aristide resigned. You know, he was a corrupt leader, and he resigned. The sense that we get on the ground here in Haiti is that, you know, we're 2 years almost after this coup d'etat happened, and people are overwhelmingly still demanding for the return of Aristide. I mean, they voted for him twice, the first time in 1990, and we have to remember that after he came into power in 91, he was overthrown after 7 months in office, again by a U.S.-sponsored coup d'etat, and then Aristide was elected again in the year 2000 and overthrown 4 years later, about a year before his mandate was up. So the situation we have in Haiti now, almost 2 years after the coup, an interim government took power under Prime Minister La Tortue. It's important to mention that the Prime Minister, Yvon Neptune, under Aristide, is now in jail, along with thousands of other political prisoners in Haiti, including people like Father Gérard Jean-Just, who was a priest and a very popular leader, a very popular figure within the La Valas movement. He's been in jail for about 5 months, I think. People like Annette Soin Auguste, who is one of Haiti's most renowned political folk singers. She's been in jail since May 2004. So it's a situation that it's lawless here, and unfortunately this lawlessness is actually coming not because of these so-called armed gangs and armed bandits that we so often hear talked about in places like Cité Soleil, which is one of the largest slums in Port-au-Prince. The lawlessness is coming because you have the United States, France, and Canada who have given their explicit and de facto support to this murderous regime that, again, who came into power through coup d'etat, which saw thousands of people perish in the first few months. And the situation is just, it continues in this downward spiral. Now, what's been happening, and this is why I feel that we're at a very important juncture in the story of Haiti right now, this interim government who came in after the coup, it was widely recognized that they had no legitimacy, right? I mean, they weren't voted in, and of course, Haiti is supposed to have this veneer of democracy right now. In fact, the U.S., France, and Canada, and the U.N., and the OAS, the Organization of American States, are really, they're the ones pushing the most for this election to happen, because when this election happens, if it does happen, and I say if, I'll explain why later, if this election happens, it legitimizes what happened in February 2004. It's going to kind of write into history the fact that Aristide stepped down and here we are now in a democracy. The reality is the situation in Haiti looks anything but a democracy right now. The presidential elections, which were supposed to happen months ago, have been delayed numerous times, four times, in fact. But now people are saying that they will almost for sure go ahead on February the 7th. February the 7th being the first round and then another round happening later on in March, March 19th, I believe. I say the big if because what's been happening in the lead up to these elections, and I think that we have to understand Haiti in terms of different class powers that are pitted against each other. The coup in 2004 was very much also led not only by some of the world's most powerful states, but also by the wealthy elite here in Haiti, who are organized and assembled under what we call the Group of 184. The Group of 184 is represented by such characters as Andy Appel. Andy Appel is the owner of Alpha Industries, one of Haiti's largest garment factory owners, and they make a lot of clothing for the Canadian-based company Gildan Activewear. Workers in Andy Appel's factories get paid 75 gourds a day, which amounts to about $2 per day. So the man is a very wealthy sweatshop owner. People like Reginald Boulous, who is the president of Haiti's Chamber of Commerce. So these are the people who were behind the coup, and now they're the ones who want to see their favorite presidential candidate, Charles Henry Baker, get elected in these elections. Of course, the thing is that, and the problem for Haiti's elite is that we have to remember that 90% of Haiti's population lives way below the poverty line. I believe the average per capita income in Haiti is around $200 US per year. A lot of people toil away in informal economies without access to to any kind of stable wage earning. Over 50% of the population cannot read or write. And we're talking about a population that certainly isn't represented by the interests of the elite, and they have given their overwhelming support to the Lavalasse party, to the party of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and now René Préval, who is the presidential candidate under Lavalasse. So the polls are indicating right now that Préval is way in the lead over anyone else. I mean, if we went to the elections tomorrow, Préval would most certainly win. But this isn't good enough for the Group of 184. So what they've been doing to safeguard their interests, in a way, is they've been putting a lot of pressure on the United Nations Stabilization Mission here, which we call MINUSTAH, And MINUSTAH literally has an occupying force here in the country. If you go down into Cité Soleil, the well-known slum of Port-au-Prince, which is home to over 300,000 people who live in very dense conditions. A lot of people have made the comparison between Cité Soleil and the Gaza Strip in Palestine. You go down into these places and you see UN tanks on constant patrol, and they've been killing untold amounts of people. The death toll for Cité Soleil, people, unarmed people killed by the UN last week was over 10. We visited a hospital, St. Catherine's Hospital in Cité Soleil, last Thursday, and patients there at the hospital told us, corroborated that at about 11 p.m. the night before, so last Wednesday, Jordanian UN troops in Cité Soleil opened fire on the hospital. And, of course, we saw bullet holes all throughout the children's ward there. So this is the kind of situation that we're seeing here in Haiti right now. There's certainly, we're expecting quite a bloodbath in the lead-up to these elections because my man, Charles Henry Baker, doesn't have a chance of winning. And I think that the elite here in Haiti, along with the support of the U.S., France and Canada and the United Nations, are going to do whatever's in their power to make sure that they get their way.
Okay. Could you answer a question about why do you feel there have been all these delays in the elections? Do you feel it's just because they can't guarantee, those that are in power in the interim government right now can't guarantee the result they want at this point? Is that why they've been delaying?
Yeah, there's a few different explanations.
Mm-hmm.
The powers that be in Haiti have blamed the delay on the elections, first of all, on the high level of insecurity that exists in the country. Kidnappings are an ongoing problem here in Haiti. Kidnappings for high ransoms. I believe there were around 400 kidnappings in the month of December alone. Although what's important to realize about the kidnappings is, for example, in one of the recent incidences, the PNH here, the National Police of Haiti, actually traced a kidnapping ring not to Cité Soleil or to any of the poor areas of the country, but actually to Pétionville, which is one of the more upscale suburbs of Port-au-Prince. So, oftentimes there are misrepresentations in the media about where exactly the crime is coming from. So there's been the problem of kidnappings, of political violence, and what we've seen is that there's a body here in Haiti in charge of organizing the elections. They're called the CEP, the Conseil des Élections Provisoires, or the Provisionary Elections Council, mm-hmm. So they're in charge of coordinating the polling stations, getting registration cards out. One of the huge problems, they say, is that out of about 3.5 million people that registered to vote, only around 1 million of those people went to pick up their ID cards. You need a biometric ID card to be able to vote in these elections that has your fingerprint and your photo and your identification on them. So that's all been problematic. The CEP has been blaming the delay in the voting on the UN and the OAS, the Organization of American States, and in turn, the UN and the OAS threw the blame back at the CEP. So we kind of see, again, the powers that be playing somewhat of a game of hot potato, over who's going to blame who. But when you ask a lot of Haitians here, a lot of people are very distrustful of these big institutions. And yes, I think it's safe to say that one of the possible reasons for the delays has been the fact that of the elite, the group of 184, who are really controlling and manipulating the political situation right now. I mean, these guys have so much influence over the UN. It's ridiculous. They want, again, they want their favorite candidate, Charles Henry Baker, to win. And it's clear that if we went to the polls tomorrow, he would lose to René Préval. So I think what they're trying to do, what's very clear, is that there's a situation of political cleansing happening right now in the capital, where the Lavalas base of support in these poor areas are being very effectively crushed by the UN.
What are the chances, assuming an election does happen, let's just say it happens February 7th or whatever day it happens, what guarantees are there that it will be fair at all, that all people will get to cast their vote, and that when the votes they do cast will be counted correctly, etc.?
Well, I mean, I don't doubt that when the elections happen, that they will be quote-unquote fair. What's happening is that there's quite a large, there's going to be a large presence of international election observers descending on Haiti very soon, of which a large amount are coming from Canada. But I think the more important question is not whether or not the elections will be fair. I mean, we can say, sure, you know, most people over a certain age went out and casted their ballots. I think that we must look at the situation within the context of a coup d'etat, and that, you know, the situation has been unfolding over the last 2 years. We're talking about a country that, again, has had democratic elections quite a few times and have seen their democracy crushed. They've seen their democracy thrown back in their faces at the hands of the United States, France, and Canada. Now, Lavalas is actually making some interesting demands around these elections. Lavalas, at first, you know, many months ago, were calling for a boycott of the elections. They were saying the interim government is not legitimate, and hence these elections are not legitimate because our democratically elected leader, who hadn't finished his mandate, was taken out of power by foreign interests. Now Lavalas is actually encouraging their supporters, encouraging their constituency to go out and vote. But they're still putting a lot of demands around the elections. One of the biggest demands is they're calling for the release of all the political prisoners here in Haiti, again, of which there are over 1,000, which I think is a perfectly legitimate demand, because these people are in jail without charges, you know, just for being the political and activist figures they are. And I don't think that if the elections happen, it will automatically guarantee a democracy for Haiti. In fact, it's quite unpredictable what the situation is going to look like over the next few months. Préval is scheduled to win, or not scheduled, but he's expected to win. And who knows, he might win. But like our friend Patrick A. Lee said, who knows what that means? I mean, we've seen what happens when people are elected democratically here in Haiti. I mean, this is a country that's suffered two coup d'etats against the same president in less than 20 years. So I think that the more important thing is we need to start looking ahead right now over the next few years. How can we guarantee a state of real peace and security and justice here in the country? And I think that the answer to that question, or to find the answer to that question, we have to look a lot more towards our own government, to the United States and Canada, to start to realize that. And tonight, actually, as we speak, Canadians are going to the polls in a federal election. I'm not too optimistic about the outcome of that because it looks like either the Liberal Party will win under Paul Martin, and the Liberal Party has been in power in Canada for over a decade. We've already seen the outcome of their foreign policy here in Haiti, or we're going to have the Conservative Party win, who will bring Canada's foreign policy much more in line with that of the Americans.
Mm. Wow. So that actually brings me to a question that's kind of backing up a little bit, looking at it a broader picture. What is your take on why Haiti? What is it about Haiti that so interests the United States and Canada and France, for that matter?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very important question, too. And it's one that's not easy to answer because, I mean, if we're to draw comparisons, let's say, to Iraq, another country that's suffered a very violent attack at the hands of the U.S. over the last few years, in Iraq, it's clear that the interest there to many were oil. Same thing with the coup in Venezuela against Chavez. But here in Haiti, you're right. I mean, we're not talking about a country that's particularly resource rich. But I think the thing with Haiti, where it would really serve the interests of the world's great powers, again, we have to look back to its history.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back a long time in Haiti's history, what happened was after the French were expelled from the country during the slave revolt, France, in fact, made Haiti pay reparations or restitution payments for over 100 years to pay back the debt that the slave owners incurred when they lost their property. So this was one of the major factors that stunted Haiti's economic growth from the very beginning. I mean, they had to pay debts to French gunboats all the way up until 1947. And then Aristide, when he was in power, had the nerve, had the gall, or the courage to demand reparations amounting to billions of dollars, because he factored in the interest.
Mm-hmm.
He demanded these reparations from the French. So right there, I think that illustrates France's interest in wanting to get Aristide out.
Mm-hmm.
If we look to the U.S., we really have to look at it, I think, in the context of racism.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be a difficult thing to see to a lot of people, but I think that white supremacy is the only way that we can accurately describe the relationship between the United States and Haiti. Haiti has traditionally been the kind of bastion of cheap labor for the Western Hemisphere. I mean, the country is overflowing with export processing zones, with sweatshops or maquiladoras or whatever you want to call them. And the United States, for decades and decades and decades after Haiti's independence, would not recognize this country's independence, partly for the reason that I believe slavery was abolished in the United States in 1865, and what Haiti represented as a free black republic was very threatening to slave owners in the United States. And what many people are saying right now is that we've come hundreds of years since slavery, but I think that the white supremacy and those kind of ideals that the slave masters held back in the 1800s, a lot of that same line of thinking is starting to resurface.
Mm-hmm.
Right now in the face of Haiti. And this is just simply, it's a country that the United States and Canada and France don't want to see have a democracy. And then finally, just to wrap up that question with Canada, because, as a Canadian, this is what particularly interests me. Canada right now has a foreign policy based on what we call responsibility to protect. And the doctrine goes that Canada has a responsibility to protect and to care for failed states. And of course, the Canadian government sees Haiti as a failed state. But I think that the bigger question, the global question that we need to ask ourselves is, why is Haiti a failed state? Could it be for those reasons that I just described of slave reparations and numerous coup d'etats? These are the more important questions that we need to be asking.
Well, there seems to be kind of a, it's almost like a domino theory of so-called free trade here. My question isn't really clear, even what I'm trying to say, but it's almost like on some level they don't want any government in this hemisphere to have true independence, such as, you know, that's why, one of the reasons why Venezuela just drives them crazy, them meaning the corporate interests that intertwine with the government interests in, you know, the U.S. and of Canada, apparently. And I mean, that's the only thing they can explain to me. Cheap labor. They want the cheap labor, and they want these, as I said, so-called free trade things to be open and available anywhere and everywhere at any given time. And anybody who seems to rise up, such as I believe Aristide was trying to do with his people, has to be slapped down. Anyway, that's obviously not a question.
The interesting thing is that a lot of people have drawn similarities between Aristide and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Aristide, of course, is very much coming from a background of liberation theology. Mm-hmm. Before he was president, he was a priest in some of Port-au-Prince's most poor and destitute areas. He had his rise to power right around the same time that the Duvalier, the infamous Papa Doc and Baby Doc Duvalier dictatorships were crumbling in the late 80s. And, Aristide, in a way, it's kind of important to mention that he had his flaws. But we're talking about a man, again, who was elected by an overwhelming majority twice. Again, once in 1991 and once in the year 2000. It's also very important to look at some of his policies when he was in power. I mentioned his demand that France repay Haiti for their slave debt. But another important thing to mention is that when Aristide was in power, he more than doubled the minimum wage in the country to around $4 U.S. per day, which, I mean, still isn't a lot, by American standards, but for Haitians that was certainly significant. So if you look at that doubling of the minimum wage, you can see how that would directly go against the interests of people like Andy Appad, who I mentioned before, our sweatshop owner friend from the Group of 184. When Aristide was in power, he also opened up a nationwide literacy program for the poor here called La Famille C'est la Vie, which was, very much done on that recognition that 50% of this country is illiterate, and that needs to change if Haiti's situation is going to change. So I think for Aristide, he very much represented the power of the poor here in Haiti, that kind of will for Haiti to actually to move up in the hemisphere, to pull itself from the chains that have held it back. I mean, it's shocking and it's disgusting that, we're talking about, again, a country that's had its independence since 1804, but we jumped ahead 202 years, and Haitians these days, it's still hard to think of this country as being an independent one when they're very much at the whim of, phenomena like free trade and like global capitalism, and the fact that they've had their democracy crushed in their face numerous times. So, and then the bigger question is, we hear Aristide, we hear him demonized and put down so much in the North American media. We hear that, you know, he's got mental problems, that the guy is crazy. I mean, people can... what I'll say is, you know, you can say what you will about Aristide and about his policies, but what we have to agree on, I think, as a moral stance, we have to say, you know, what gives us the right, as people living in the richest countries of this hemisphere, to go in and to remove a democratically elected leader from power? And I think that we don't have the right whatsoever.
Right. I think that that's certainly the crux, and there's... Haiti remains, unfortunately, in a pseudo colonial state, and that's the corporate interests, government interests, whatever, the money interests seem to want to keep them in that state, and that's why it's valuable that independent reporters like yourself are able to go down and spend the time and share this information with folks, and I appreciate it. I think we probably need to wrap it up, Aaron, because we needed to get it in a short enough package so people will be interested in listening to it. which I, of course, I'm sure people will be very interested. Any other times I've done anything on Haiti, there's been a lot of interest. Let's just put it that way. So, thank you. Is there anything you want to share just as a wrap up? I know this is obviously ongoing. It's a very tense situation a lot of the time down there. Anything else you want to say?
Yeah, I mean, what I've been telling a lot of people through reports like this is. I like to plug a couple websites because
it's
very, very hard to find. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yep.
Okay. I wanted to plug a couple websites because it's very hard to find accurate and independent reporting and information and analysis on Haiti.
Okay.
So I wanted to plug a website for the Haiti Information Project. It's www.haitiaction.net.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I mean, I think it's very important, certainly within the next few weeks, for people to keep a very close eye on Haiti and to pay attention to what's happening here. Because, like I said, it's a bloodbath. Many are expecting it'll get worse. And I think that the only way we're in a position to act is if we can get clear and accurate information. So, just as a last message, I really hope that people continue to consult the news and pay attention and care about what's happening in Haiti.
Very good. Thank you. We'll put that website up on the when we get this on the internet as well and share that with folks. And again, Aaron, I appreciate your spending time with us and appreciate the courage that, I don't know if you'd agree, but I certainly feel the courage that it takes for you and others to be down there and trying to keep the truth flowing this direction. So perhaps we'll talk again.
Thank you for having me on again.
You're welcome, Aaron. Have a great day.
You too.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We were talking with Aaron Lakoff, who's an independent journalist and activist from Montreal, Quebec, Canada. Aaron is in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. This is Scott Burguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. Thank you for listening.